Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. Our speaker today is Mary Beth O'Halloran, who was RE director in this building in 1984 to 86 at Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. Subsequent to that, she went to seminary, became a UU minister, and served as a UU minister for small congregations in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa for 10 years, and then she was a teacher at Century College in the suburban the Twin Cities for 16 years, and 4 years ago retired to Wisconsin. So welcome, Mary Beth.
Thank you. Well, you gave a little bit of the background, but I grew up Catholic, so in the olden days of Latin Mass and everything, and really accepted all of that, and studied philosophy as a college major and grad school as well. And once I started studying philosophy, my ideas changed a lot. I had all this theology background as well, but the philosophy kind of took precedence over it. It turns out I actually had, as a teacher in Washington, the son of one of the writers of the Humanist Manifesto. If he had only mentioned it, you know, way back then, I would have been a humanist a lot sooner. But once I found out about it, I figured this is really where I am. It's reason and goodness for its own sake, and so on. I also consider myself a Taoist, the Chinese naturalistic religion, or philosophy probably, and that also is very humanistic. It's, you know, the natural world is what there is, and isn't it beautiful, and enjoy it. So as a teacher in the Twin Cities, I taught all the philosophy courses, but my specialty is world religions, and I always had at least a couple of sections of it. I was figuring out the other day, I've probably had about 4,000 students in world religions classes. And I mean, that to me is just a wonderful thing. I got to talk to them about different kinds of beliefs. And I was very careful not to mention my own UU background, unless they really asked for it at the end of the semester, but I didn't want to influence them, you know, at a personal level like that. but I did, every religion we studied, I had some kind of an activity with it. And one of the things I always asked them was, have you ever had a mystical experience? And across the board, everybody says, no, not me. Never even heard of it, much less ever had it. And then I'd start naming some possibilities. And somebody would say, oh, yeah, I did have that happen. And, oh, yeah, I had that happen, too.
Did the college have a religious affiliation?
No, it's a public state school. Yeah. Yeah. And then this was in the philosophy department. There was no theology department at all. So what eventually got people thinking that they might have had mystical experiences were things like, I said, do you have any children? So women, when you gave birth, was that a mystical experience? And almost all of them said yes. And then once that happened, a few of the men would say, oh yeah, me too. Like maybe a third of the men. And then I'd say, how about women, did you go to Girl Scouts and have Scout Zones? And that was it. It's a little ceremony of readings and songs and kind of like a Vespers calming kind of event. So once they started thinking about it, they all said that they'd had things like that. Let me say one more thing first here. And probably all of you have had mystical experiences too. Ever sat out practically all night watching the Northern Lights? Can't see them down here anymore probably, but. Or incredible sunsets where you just say, oh, this is so awesome. So, yeah. Were you raising your hand?
No.
Oh, you're just getting unsticky.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I was curious.
Yeah. I was getting unsticky.
How you define mystical
experiences?
Well, that will come at the end here. So.
Okay,
well,
just kind of,
I can't answer the idea within myself if I've ever had a mystical experience.
Well, that's why I was trying to give some examples of what people, once they thought about it, they identified it that way. It's kind of an emotional response to some unusual experience outside. But it's not just, there's a sunset. I understand that this is the sun going down under the horizon, and there's some glow because of the atmosphere, the stuff in the atmosphere. You know, like when Mount St. Helens erupted, the sunsets were just incredible. But it was because of the smoke in the atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, but what you're talking about seems like a whole other thing than what, like Julian and Norwich would.
That's
Joan of Arc.
Right.
So
because those were within
that?
The Christian, those were mystical experiences within the Christian theology.
Yeah,
but people who aren't Christian,
well, there's Kabbalah too. I mean,
right, or the Jewish, or the Hindus have them,
but,
and
I mean,
Buddhists
seems
have them, and
like a whole other.
These are, because what I'm...
What you're describing.
Yeah, because what I'm talking about is humanism, and to me that is the human being and the human community and the natural world. So it's, what I'm talking about is the same kind of biological experience that a Catholic or a Buddhist or whoever would have as a mystical experience, but totally based in human relations or in the natural world. So the examples of sunsets and northern lights, those are all examples of that.
Well, what I would call one is when I was playing my trombone in a contest, you know, high school contest. Yeah. And I went to this contest, and I had never played the trombone like I played it for that. And, you know, it just, all the music just slid out of my trombone. I never heard it like that.
You jumped to a different level.
Yeah, and I explained it as being, there must be somebody in that audience who really knew that piece and was sending to me, and I was receiving.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But it was quite the experience.
Yeah. I learned how, from somebody who was good at it, to see auras. I can't just sit here and look at you and say, oh, your aura is purple or whatever. But almost all of my classes, I would say probably 80% of the students learned how to see auras. It's not that difficult. And that, again, that was something just so awesome. But it's a biological experience. It has to do with
nothing magic,
nothing mystical, or in the religious sense, nothing spiritual. God's not giving that. It's just the way the brain works. And so in a sense, what I'm going toward is mystical humanism as a brain experience. And then that puts it totally in the natural world then. So when I tell people that, it depends. It doesn't matter which word I use. Whether I say I'm a humanist or if I say I'm an atheist, the response I get from those students, a lot of them, or from sitting on the beach and that happens to come up or wherever, they say, "Oh, how can you do that? How can you be good if you don't believe in God and hell? What keeps you from raping and pillaging and murdering and slaughtering and everything else? Anything you want to do?" And my only response can be, "I don't want to do those things. Why would you think I want to do those things?" You know, it has nothing to do with God or hell. God setting a whole bunch of rules that you have to follow and fear of going to hell forever. I mean, that's a real fear for most Christians, and maybe not the universalists so much, but for many people. And I think that's a kind of an illegitimate response to talking about atheism or humanism. There's one that I think is kind of legitimate, at least on the border of it, and that is... how you can get to reasoning to some same conclusions about mystical experiences. So part of what I want to talk about is that the experiences that we have can be totally in the natural area, that awesome sense. And awesome is an overused word, kind of like your minister was talking about love being overused. But I think we all have that experience of awe and just amazement at how the world is. So let me first talk about the ethical issues. Why would anybody want to be immoral? Why would you want to kill anybody? I can understand getting really mad and wishing you could just beat them over the head, but to go out and deliberately kill people, that's not a human, normal human reaction. If there's no God out there that says, you shouldn't do that, so then I won't because God said not to, is there any other reason that I would choose to be moral? Same thing with hell. If I'm not afraid of hell, is there any other reason that I would not want to do immoral things? You know that the kind of the moral standards of behavior are pretty much universal. And there are some exceptions. I mean, we allow capital punishment, for example, which might be a moral issue in terms of murder. But basically, the same values are all around the world and in all ages. And they have to do with being kind to your neighbor and not hurting one another, not stealing other people's stuff. So just not harming one another. And I think that is a totally natural, totally human experience and desire and value. I choose to be good, not because I'm afraid of hell, but because I respect myself and want to do my best, and because I respect other people and want to do well for them. And if I can't help other people, well, at least I won't harm them. And that would be the moral choice. And that's very much a humanist idea, that we can reason to ethical considerations and to ethical conclusions that have to do with being our best as human beings. I mean, that's kind of what humanism is about. It's leading to the fulfillment of human nature. That's even, I think the word fulfillment is even in all of the humanist manifestos, because that's all there is. We're not aiming, to my mind, for living in heaven forever, but for fulfilling my personality, my potential, and fulfilling that of other people to the extent I can. I can't make you be, you know, the president of the United States or something, but I can, in little tiny ways, help you fulfill whatever it is that are your values and whatever your goals. And that is an ethical stance, saying, I'm going to help these people as much as I can. And you do it in social justice. That was interesting to hear about the Beacon House, as that was called, that's going to be something you're committed to. That's a way of helping people and fulfilling human nature. And I want to be good just for human's sake. Doesn't have to depend on God, doesn't have to depend on theology or hell or anything else like that. And respecting others and respecting myself. And with that as my motivation, I can be thoughtful about it. I can say, well, what if this, what if that? Come up with various considerations, talk about it with other people. You know, what do you think about capital punishment? What do you think about war? All of those issues. And come together to value people at the highest level. That humans are the highest, I hate to use the word creation, but they're the kind of the peak of development of biology and science and all the rest of that. We don't necessarily have to have been formed by God. In fact, I don't think that's the case at all. But however our evolution has happened, we are reasoning beings. And maybe we're still evolving. And who knows, maybe at some point, 1,000 years from now, it'll be a totally different kind of human being. But at this point, human values and human experience is what is, to me, the highest value. So I'm going to be good because I respect other people, and I think that's definitely within the humanist family there. Then the other piece of that is our experiences of awe, and think about nature. If you look up at the stars at night and think, those are stars and there are universes out there, and there's infinity out there. That's just incredible. I'm so small in comparison, and yet I can see it, and I can think about it, and I can kind of understand it. Science eventually will understand better, but I have at least some minimal level of understanding it. And when I talk about those kinds of things and ask people, have they ever had that kind of natural awe experience, the thing that I get from non-humanists is, yes, but that just proves there's a God. Well, no, not to me. That's not where my reasoning leads. I can. This is the one that I think is kind of a legitimate argument, that if all of this order in the universe is here, and which it certainly is, somebody has to have started it. There has to be a first cause, one of the classic arguments for the existence of God. Something has to have started it. That has to be God. Well, no. I mean, you can go to Big Bang kinds of ideas, and that works just as well. And if there's that kind of order in the universe, somebody must be stirring it up and moving things around and making sure that everything stays orderly. Well, no, I don't think so. My reason says not that proves there's a God, but isn't that doubly awesome that there is that order now? So, yeah.
Last week we celebrated Warren Hagstrom's life, and one of his favorite songs was the Galaxy Song. Are you familiar with it?
No, I'm not.
Oh, so it's basically about how big the universe is and how many million miles.
Oh, the Monty Python?
The galaxy
yeah.
is.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, anyway, I was feeling kind of bad about Warren's death. And then I was one of the people asked to, you know, play the ukulele and sing it. And it was very comforting. And the point of it was, you know, it's just a wonder that that a person is born.
Yeah.
And has, you know, amazing. Has a very strong chance.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very comforting. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was very
and
comforting
it's you.
To realize, you know, how little you are, but you got to be born.
Yeah. This sperm and this egg, and otherwise you wouldn't have been there.
And it's from the movie The Meaning of Life.
Okay.
Which is real wrong.
Yeah, so at the human's relatively small level, at the universe level, at the microscopic level, the things that happen with germs and like diseases that mutate when we start giving them antibiotics, they mutate so that they keep surviving and are no longer killed off by our drugs.
I'm gonna say one more thing.
Okay.
My sisters are very fundamentalist Christian and very judgmental about everything. And she was a farmer's wife, and you know, she would, when a cow or a calf would get sick, she would pray for the cow or calf, and if it survived, she was sure it was God that it had done it, and it was a miracle. And my point of view was, it was a miracle, but miracles are happening inside us all the time. You know, it's just amazing, all this, you know, that your body continues to live, and there's all this factory going on inside of it, you know, it's all a miracle, but she doesn't see it that way. She sees the intervention of God is making things happen or not happen.
What I don't understand is that if God is able to intervene that minutely, why do we have any problems at all?
Yeah, why are there hurricanes? So the world is orderly, but there are part of the order is destruction, creation.
So one of the things that you're talking about is why people are inherently good and why do we care about other people. And this is not necessarily entirely my belief, but I believe there's some point in you put yourself in danger of other people attacking you if you attack someone else.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily, I don't know.
Well, it's self-interest.
Self-interest.
But it could be enlightened self-interest. I mean, I could...
It could be enlightened, or it could just be unconscious.
Survival.
And, yeah. And we don't take that with a chicken.
Yeah.
We don't take that with a hog in confinement.
Right.
And it might be because there's less chance of the hog coming out and killing me. Or confining me.
Yep.
And so I think there could be those elements into why we treat each other with more kindness and respect than we do pigs and cows and things of that nature.
Also, that's how things work. I mean, evolutionarily, everybody is
self-interested.
Is nice to everybody else and kind of fosters because we started out in small groups. I mean, it wouldn't work if you were raping and killing and pillaging.
You would be ostracized.
It would, and that's exactly what happened to people in those days. If you were ostracized from the group, that was essentially a death sentence.
Right.
So, you know, I think evolutionarily, it works. You know, so consequently, it reinforces.
Self-reinforces.
That's the enlightened self-interest aspect.
Evolutionarily, there is also a they. The other group.
Yeah.
Well, that's true.
Oh, yeah. The enemies in the next village.
Right.
Yeah. But that's
your resources.
Evolutionary self-interest then says this village and this village combine, and now we've got a city, and it gets ordered in a different way and sets up new rules or mutual rules maybe. Yeah.
So the fact that we obey the traffic rules even when there's no policeman watching you is sort of like obeying thou shalt not kill, even though there's no God watching you.
Yep. But so why do you do that?
Not all of us do that.
Well, you mentioned on evolution, I was a research biologist, but one of the things that was truly amazing to me is I took this course and it was the reproductive strategies of parasites.
Okay.
Bacteria increase and kill. Viruses increase and kill. But parasites, if they kill their host, they don't have a host. They make them sick, but they can only make them sick to a certain point that they're still keep going so that the parasite can continue to live within the host. So it's this synergistic relationship. And the reproductive strategies are absolutely phenomenal for how the parasite not only has to find the right species, but enter the right species the right way and have the right life cycle that matches the species that's the right species.
Wow.
Because if it gets into the wrong one, when you hear about things like, you hear about Balus ascaris, which is a raccoon roundworm. If it gets into a human, it will kill them. If it gets into a dog, it will kill them.
The parasite will kill the animal.
But if it gets into the right animal, which is the raccoon, it doesn't bother them at all.
Oh.
So it's like very interesting, all the strategies. And these strategies can be a 20-year-long life cycle strategy of keeping their hosts sick.
Wow. But minimally.
It's truly amazing all of those levels of you were talking about. Where do things start? Where do things stop? What controls what happens? Yeah. And it's phenomenal. And
talk about order in the universe.
Oh, it's just, yeah. It's,
at the microbe level. Yeah.
Fascinating course.
Even as a scientist, and you've seen awesome things. You understand that as awesome.
I know awesome.
Yeah, you may not have looked at them, but you know. But I think most of us, just as you know, in terms of sunsets and babies being born and so on, and that miracle, my heart beating is a miracle. And my goodness, how the brain works. So the other one of the piece of the objections that people have when I say I'm an atheist or a humanist. Is they say, well, don't you have a spiritual life? And the answer is, yes, I do. I have a wonderful spiritual life. I enjoy it immensely. It has to do with feelings of awe, feelings just in general, feelings of love, with meditation. And meditation changes the brain waves. Any kind of meditation, instead of that active, busy, chattery mind, we drop into a lower brain wave state, slower, calmer. And it changes our attitudes. Meditation before surgery or meditation during a stressful time. It seems like it's a waste of time, but it changes the brain. And that's getting into then spiritual life as a word I've just come across recently, neurotheology. So theology to me always meant something having to do with God, either whether God exists or the nature of God. And how, if there is a God, how would on earth will we know how the Trinity functions inside itself? You know? But neurotheology says we have spiritual experiences, and they are biological experiences, that they can be tracked biologically, physically. And there are two studies that I've just recently been reading about. One of them had some flaws in the design of it, and they apparently let the test subjects know a little bit too much ahead of time, so they might not have gotten a true response. This was a group of Carmelite nuns. So they were, you know, women, Catholic, religious, living in a community and doing a lot of praying and other kinds of spiritual things. And they did a galvanic skin response test and asked them to remember some particularly strong spiritual or mystical experiences. And they got a biological reaction, a physical reaction, when people were remembering these events. And this is the study that might be somewhat flawed, but at least it's a starting point. There's been a more recent one that seems to be pretty good and is getting some acceptance. And this was a larger group of Franciscan sisters, so again, Catholic nuns. And they set it up so that the sisters would actually do centering prayer while they were being tested. And the centering prayer is saying repeatedly some phrase. The one that I know is actually from the Russian Orthodox. It's, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior, have mercy on me, a sinner. Russian Orthodox perspective. But it's basically the same thing as, say, Hindus chanting mantras, the whatever phrase it would be, the transcendental meditation. People had mantras. So that's the idea behind centering prayer. So these Franciscans would be all hooked up to have a dye being injected at random points, and they would practice centering prayer, and their brain waves lit, or their brain scans, not waves, the scans, lit up when they were doing this centering prayer. So they would say, go ahead and pray now, and they'd inject some dye, and then they'd say, "Go stop praying," and they, you know, each time they never knew when the dye was going in because it was intravenous. And when they were doing the praying, there were like a half a dozen bright red spots that were not there when they were not praying, when they were in between cycles. So there needs to be a whole lot more research that way. But that's neurotheology. You're saying here is a religious activity, and it has a neurological effect. So we are biology. We're nature. We're natural. We're part of nature. And all of the brain activities, all of our neurological responses, our muscle responses, everything, are responsive to spiritual experiences. So even if you think you've never had a mystical experience, I'm sure you have. Too bad you weren't hooked up to some machinery at the time. But this is kind of the direction that the other phrase that's relatively new is mystical humanism. I threatened last night to talk about mystical humanism today. And that's what it is to me. It's mystical experiences, whatever that is. Some has having to do primarily for me with awe at nature. And the recognition that this is still within the humanist realm. It's all about nature. It's all about human activities, human brains, human neurology, and it is somehow mystical at the same time. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm curious. You know, I would expect that if I watched NFL football, and then I stopped watching NFL football and I watched PBS,
yep,
that my brain waves would change.
Mm-hmm.
And so mine I'm not sure what the relevance of praying and seeing your brain change and...
Well, no, other things would do that, too.
Everything, wouldn't
yeah.
it? Really, if I ate a bologna sandwich or I ate a peanut butter sandwich.
No, not
a little. Way. Yeah.
Well, I think...
Yeah, this
I think
this is extreme reaction.
It's been different areas of the brain.
Sure, yeah, but you would point out that things change. And if I wanted to, I could say that eating a peanut butter sandwich is mystical as opposed to eating a ham sandwich.
Well, you would probably have to sit there and meditate on the peanut butter sandwich and
I
really
don't think so.
Get into the emotionality of the peanut butter or the sandwich.
So
or something.
Are you really into the peanut butter sandwich when you eat it consciously or not, and realize you're having an experience?
I would expect, you know, I push...
No, I mean, just really, I mean, are you conscious of it?
What is it, the principle about observing something changes the...
The observer yeah. being there changes the event.
The yeah. event, oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. 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 Definitely there.
They've done yeah. similar research with monks.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which have done Tibetan monks who
yes.
have done meditation
yeah.
and chanting.
Yeah.
They've shown
yeah.
that during a long period of uh-huh. meditation and chanting that they change everything. It changes
yep.
their blood pressure, their pulse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I like questions.
Brain waves and so it's...
Yeah.
And that's what they want with people yeah. to do is with how biofeedback works.
Yeah.
And I have a question that they don't know when the dye is going in because
no.
the time I had the dye, I got a hot flash.
Oh, did you? Well, maybe the dosage is less or something. I don't know.
I mean,
but still,
you know,
you could
consider
say,
that a mystical experience.
You
and he went in a flash.
Yeah.
We've got your obituary written.
Right. And what you were talking about might be a chicken and egg question. Were these monks accustomed to chanting and meditating?
Yes.
And that's why they had some different reaction. Whereas, and they were doing it intentionally and with spiritual intent versus a peanut butter sandwich. Mostly we don't do it very consciously. I mean, that whole slow eating movement is about trying to change that.
Well,
so
I would
the
suggest
makes
that,
a
that they're just not even studying it.
Well,
that these people
not
have,
peanut butter
these
sandwiches
people have an agenda.
That is
and that's
basic,
why, what?
Yeah.
That is actually the basic flaw of those types of studies because yeah. who they study are people who pray or chant or
right.
et cetera, et cetera.
Well, they surely have
that's what they're trying to get to.
One of my
to, yeah.
favorite
yeah,
they do.
Yeah.
books
yeah.
pointed out that, children's books that I read, recently pointed out that if you want to teach meditation, it depends entirely on who you're teaching, how to figure out how to teach them to properly meditate. So one person, for example, the lady got through exercise.
Yep.
And exercise probably gets several people, I know it kind of gets me, into that sort of meditative state
yep.
if you do it long.
Changes
enough.
Your biology.
And that is just plain exercise. I'm not
yep.
going chan.
Yeah.
Swimming laps,
yeah.
for example. So to get that to be an accurate study, yeah, you have to have like a control group that doesn't do study, and then you, but
yeah.
then you also have to have different types of meditation going on.
Yeah.
Or activities.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and this is
exactly
kind of an initial study.
It's
just
this chance.
Yeah.
All you're getting is you're getting when people, when Tibetan monks who have practiced it for a long time chant, their brain functions change.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, but that's really not
meaningful.
All that much.
Yeah.
Well, it's meaningful
you really
from a biological perspective.
Susan, if someone, if you're swimming and you get into this meditative state or whatever, you know, a state of mind that you recognize as being important.
Yeah, my knee hurts. My knee hurts.
No, no. Knee hurts.
It's a runner's high.
Else, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the point of the children's book that I read was that if you want to get somebody to learn how to meditate, you don't sit them down in a row and have them chant. You do whatever is necessary for the person because everybody's an individual.
So exercise might be one of those things.
Yeah.
And there are meditation forms that are exercise,
like
Tai Chi.
Dancing with the kids to get them.
So would you characterize just reading the newspaper as meditative? I mean, how do you describe what meditative is?
Well, I think it can be for any, I mean, sitting in a comfortable chair with a soft light and a good book, I mean, I can go away for hours.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think it's somewhat of a...
So is it whenever you're relaxed, is that a meditative mean, or is it something more?
One, when you're just focusing, for me it's if I'm focusing on one thought or one idea so that you close out
surrounding
everything that's people have different things they do to go to sleep at night.
Right.
Some of the early brainwave studies, people could reach that point doing bookkeeping to help balancing the checkbook. It was because of the concentration and focus. And everything else is excluded, and they're zeroed in on this.
Well, I can give a good example of that. You know, I don't like the noise of the belt line and all the trash that's there and everything like that. And normally it makes me nervous to be there, but I'm also a photographer, so a couple of years ago I just had my camera with me, and I went along the belt line between Seminole Highway and down the toward the east. And I was taking pictures of all the weed flowers. And I totally forgot about all the belt line noise and all the plastic cups and beer bottles and all the stuff that was there. And it was a wonderful experience. I was really concentrating on that. So to me, you know, that's a meditative experience, can be a meditative experience.
Like art is that way. So you were doing art. And, you know, it could be painting or drawing or knitting. Could be. Could
all,
that could be a chore also.
Watching foreign films that have
subtitles on.
Right.
I tried to do that the other day.
I think it's bugging me these days when they show a telephone screen with a text message. And I'm like, I can't read that.
Yeah
on TV.
That's not meditating.
No, but I meant that's like foreign films. Yeah.
That was the one that was the Australian living in.
Yes,
right?
The 800
words. Yeah, we've
got to
put subtitles on
it. Well, I pause it and I go up to the screen. And
now, well, my big problem with those tests is, I mean, they basically take a subset of people who have practiced something for a long time.
That was their purpose.
You know. By taking the religious people, they sort of increase the status of the religious people. Whereas, you know, if they had done it with... Well, as I say, athletes, that would be, you know, raising the status of athletes. But by doing it by a single group of people like that, these people are...
Susan, they did the university, the studies that they've been doing at the university.
James Richardson.
Then he took a bunch of just people off the
street. Yeah, the control
group, and did their initial things. And then they taught them how to meditate, and they could watch... The
brain
studies change over time as they became more skilled. So they had a control group, and then they worked with them, and they were able to.
They uncontrolled them.
They uncontrolled them. Right? But they were able to develop the changes.
That's more like a more repeatable study.
That's what they did at the university.
And this one with the Franciscans is kind of like a beginning step. And they, for example, they required that they had to have been doing this meditation for at least 15 years. 15 years of regular meditation is going to change a person. So, mm-hmm. yeah, so they wanted that condition to start with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think a good study is if you take young parents with a newborn, and the methods they come up with to make the newborn go to sleep are I mean, things like running your vacuum cleaner, sticking them in a car, driving around the block 100
right.
times.
Oh,
yeah. There's all sorts of things that people have come up with, holding them upside down, this way, that way, on their belly, on their back, what people will come up with. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure at some point that's got to be connected to what's happening in those infants' brains, yep. what calms them that when nothing else calms them. Mine mm-hmm. used to.
And one of the measures is how calm are the parents?
Oh, yeah. What I used to do is, because we hadn't had the car seat in the back seat, so I used to massage my daughter's foot. I could reach her foot. I would massage the foot I would reach, and she's still at 35, loves to have her feet massaged.
Early experience.
As soon as I started massaging your foot, she would just nod off. And oh. It was just a silly thing that I could do because I could reach. But I think that everybody has levels of what they do, what works for them, to put mm-hmm. them in a quieter, calmer place if you're going mm-hmm. to exist in this world. And I start listening to the news or listening to what's happening in Washington, D.C., and I go, okay, cup of tea, turn everything off, and turn on some jazz, and I'll sit there and listen to jazz, drink tea, and get in my head. But, you know, whatever you work out. I'm sure that we can all take ourselves to another plane somewhere. Mm-hmm. Call it whatever you want to call it. Yeah. I think it's out there.
In my world religions classes, we did some activity from every religion, and a lot of them were meditative. And I would, you know, introduce it and describe it, and either in silence or with my saying some words sometimes, go through the experience. And inevitably, there would be like a magic point about 3 minutes in where the energy in the room changed. And I sensed it as soon as it happened, and a lot of other people afterwards would say, you know, something happened in there, a little while into it. And they said, what did you experience? And it was like calmer and quieter, and I didn't hear any noises.
Oh, when I was a fourth grade teacher, you know, sometimes the kids would just get wired. And I'd say, well, we're going to have a minute of silence. And then I would say, you know, if you're not silent for that minute, we'll just have another minute. Because that's kind of the threat.
A threat, right?
But, you know, one day they were all being wired, and I said, we're going to have a minute of silence, and just listen to the sounds of the school. And so we had our minute of silence. Nobody ever interrupted that. They all did do their minute of silence. And this one little boy who was the most wired said, Ms. Mullen, I really needed that. He got himself calmed down.
There's a thing they use with children. It's the four B's. And it's a way to get kids who are, they're using it, they're teaching it in Madison. They teach it in the public school system through the Hancock Center for Movement Therapy. And it's the four B's, and it goes, it's brain, breathing, I can't remember the body and something else, and they just teach these kids. And they've had it, but the teachers have declared that it has completely changed their classrooms when they can stop the kids and say, we're going to do the four B's. And I know it's, they put their hands, it's like brain, breath, body, and
belly.
I can't even tell you. But they teach it to these kids in the school system, and it has almost totally eliminated in these classrooms bullying and aggressive behavior, and because it's helped the kids that were, like Mary said, the kids that were really going off the string, helped them to get focused and back in with everybody mm-hmm. else. And it's worked. There's a book out on this and how this therapy can be used, and it's also, they use it with children on the autism spectrum.
Okay.
But when they try to teach them to feel when they're spiraling.
Yeah.
And things are starting to change for them, they can just stop, go back, brain, breathe. So yeah. There's some really good stuff going on, at least with schools now. Yeah. But it's that same, this is all the same process. It's just making it accessible for the teachers and
Yeah, I had not heard the four B's, but just breathing, just helping somebody breathe when they're off the wall is often enough. I worked with institutionalized teenagers, years ago before I came here. And when they were, I mean, getting violent and you know, just sobbing and hysterical and whatever else, if I could get them to hold still long enough and put my hand on their diaphragm so that I could kind of help control their breathing and slow it down, it was magic. That worked. Yeah. And that breathing itself, by itself, is a meditation technique. Penny?
Oh, I would just... Now that we've got good humanists figured out, how do we explain evil and sociopaths?
That's a problem.
And oftentimes, part of religion.
Yeah.
I guess I could have a solution or to your question
not
about
a solution, but an
idea.
Yeah.
I think if you have organisms that all do the same thing, they'll eventually die out. I think you want organisms to have a variety of responses to the same stimulus in order that if the environment changes, a few of them will survive. So
okay.
I think you want to have some things, you know, otherwise if everything does the same thing, I think there's an easy choke point for that organism.
Mm-hmm. I think more of that.
Yeah, you want to have most of them about the same, but you want a few fringes that go off in different directions.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like, to have light, you must have darkness. So
well,
by having an example of how far people can go wrong, it helps clarify your thinking about what's right living.
Is that kind of like the idea that to identify disease is only the absence of the disease in other people? You know, if we all have the same disease, then we don't have a disease.
Yeah. And it's normal.
You know? Yeah, it's normal.
Yeah. Then why do these sociopaths get listened to at all?
They offer some hope out of things, yeah. But I think eventually we're going to discover a biological explanation for sociopaths and psychopaths, that there is something biologically different from the normal human body, and they literally have no conscience. So where is a conscience? Is it? I mean, it seems to be in the frontal lobes. Because people who have injuries there will sometimes end up without a conscience.
Do you mean conscience or do you mean empathy?
Conscience.
Oh. So
they probably don't have empathy either, but they can't make moral decisions. That are anything other than I want what I want when I want it.
So a conscience is what tells you what's right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the definition? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's so many people who at this point in their life in this country don't have anything that they have that can center them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the economics or the home or the family or setting or whatever it is that they can have timeouts and they can get themselves rejuvenated, and they're just constantly cranked up. And I think these people are very easily influenced.
The Maslow
by someone who is
hierarchy of needs,
right,
kind of thing.
Well, and if you're just kind of on that fringy edge of detonating all the time, it's very easy to follow people who are.
Yeah.
Manipulators of those people.
Well, I read the book that The Wire was based on. I can't remember if that was the title of The Wire, about Baltimore and the drug culture. And they talked about how little kids, you know, come to school or, you know, they're just in, you know, in the neighborhood. And, you know, they're kind of trusting in the beginning, most of them, and so on. But the older kids do stuff to them to... crimp them. The word is crimp. They get crimped.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're taught not to trust. They're taught never to that they always have to be on the alert and they have to be aware of who's got the power, and they've got to kind of bow to it, I think. That's what I would call crimped.
Years ago there was a public service announcement that showed little kids, black and white, and the announcement was, we have to be taught how to hate. I think
the song, we have to be carefully taught.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's what it was from, huh?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, when I was in Atlanta as an exchange student down to Spelman College, I had my camera, of course. I have a picture of, I was at Spelman College, and it was surrounded by a chain link fence.
Oh.
The neighborhoods, you know, separated off the college. And I have a picture of a little white boy who was one of the professor's kids, I think, in, you know, within Spelman, and a little black kid outside the fence holding hands through the fence.
Oh, yeah.
So they were able to make friends through the fence.
Well, I know you need to leave. Do you have anything you want to do to conclude?
No, just leave the thought of mystical humanism out there and see where you want to go with it and sometime in your future.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Yes, thank you're welcome.
Very
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for inviting me. This has been fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I like theory. I like talks that challenge my ideas.
Yeah.
Well, we have her scheduled for the October 8th.
Yes.
To do for our sources series.
Oh, yeah. It's October
yes.
or November?
October.
October.
I'll be
here.
I'll be in Oregon.
Oh. Yeah.
So that's our Humanist Day. October 8th will be a Humanist Day.
It's the second Sunday.
Normally it would be on the first Sunday.
Oh.
And October 1st.
I thought you meant there was
a day.
We're missing.
Right, we don't have anything scheduled.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Outside where we have better light than I
Oh, okay. And a cookbook.
Well,